All right, have you heard the term beast mode? How many people have heard that term beast mode? Yeah? It's a pretty popular term in our culture today. You know, one of the ways I could explain it, probably a simple way, is that here's a picture of our worship leader, Scott, right? Everybody say hi, Scott. Right? Now, here's a picture of Scott in beast mode. Yeah. So that's Scott getting excited before the worship service back in the prayer room. Every Sunday morning he gets into beast mode, gets real excited about our worship service, and we're so glad to have him. So you guys didn't know, I mean, he shaves when he gets into beast mode. He doesn't have the goatee. And you didn't know he had that tattoo on his arm. But other than that, this is Scott in beast mode. Well, anyway, if you could go back to the other slide there. So seriously, beast mode, as you may have heard the term, is something that is used to refer typically to athletes if they're having a pretty dominating performance, right? They're pretty aggressive, competitive, dominating performance. And the term, from my understanding, was popularized by a star running back for the Seattle Seahawks, they were a basketball team like 20 years ago. They don't even exist anymore. But Seattle Seahawks, who've been to the last two Super Bowls, Marshawn Lynch. And he's even got a clothing line with this, and he's known for having some of his dominating play that's helped lead the Seahawks to the last two Super Bowls. But I found out this week, no kidding, I was Wednesday morning, I'm just reading the paper over a bowl of cereal before I go to work, and I'm reading through the sports section, and it told me this very, very interesting piece of information that Starbucks, which is based in Seattle, where Seattle Seahawks are and beast mode Marshawn Lynch plays, has developed, believe this or not, a beast mode Frappuccino. Yeah, those of you who like Frappuccinos, be sure to get a beast mode Frappuccino. Listen to this. It is described as I quote, as unique as its creator, a double mocha Frappuccino with a hint of mint and cream and just enough protein powder to unleash your inner beast mode. So if you drink a Starbucks beast mode Frappuccino, I guess you will be able to go into beast mode, I guess. I don't know. So anyway, Starbucks aside, as dominating and conquering as beast mode himself is to an NFL defense, or as dominating and successful as an athlete gets in so-called beast mode, we come to a passage this morning where it describes someone who is way beyond and way better than beast mode. And in fact, we're going to see in our passage this morning as we continue through our series in Daniel that there have been and there are kingdoms who have conquered and dominated entire regions of the world throughout history. But there is someone who has even greater dominion. There is someone who has gone and will go, in a sense, way beyond beast mode to ultimately conquer, dominate, and carry out the purposes of his dominion. Who is this? And how is he beyond beast mode? And how does he defeat his opponents and take his dominion? Let's look this morning here in Daniel 7. We're going to read verses 1 through 14. So we've been going through entire chapters. This week, the next 2 weeks, there's so much here in chapter 7, we're going to do it in two weeks. So we're going to look through the first half of Daniel 7, verses 1 through 14. Before we do, would you please join me in prayer? Heavenly Father, we are thankful for your word and the privilege it is to study it today. We are thankful for your great love for us, and we're thankful for your dominion and your power and your truth. And show us today how the truths here of this passage do directly apply to our understanding of you and to what is to come and to our lives as we live here in 2015. In Jesus' name, amen. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, And it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And it was told, "Arise, devour much flesh." After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as wool, as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then, because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away. But their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Well, before we go through the details of our passage and come to the primary point, we need to recognize and establish here that what is going on as we enter into chapter 7 through the end of the book of Daniel, it is a little bit of a shift in the type of writing, or the genre, if you will, that is present here. In the first 6 chapters, we have predominantly a narrative, which is telling details about events that happened. And now we still have some discussion of some events that happened. I mean, Daniel really had this vision. But he's describing the vision, and much of what takes place are descriptions of visions and things that Daniel has seen. And these visions and things that he has seen is something that is known as apocalyptic language. And that means it's discussing matters that may include the past and present events of his time, but ultimately point towards the end of the age. So let's talk about apocalyptic writing for a few minutes here. So apocalyptic writing can be confusing. And it's often really, really misconstrued. It's often really, really misunderstood and misinterpreted. And part of it is because it is marked by symbolism and symbolic language. And the difficulty often becomes with who or what is being symbolized in apocalyptic language. So, for example, years ago when I first became a Christian in college at Purdue University, my freshman year, I remember it wasn't too long after that, and I believe Gorbachev was in power in Russia. And people were going around and saying that, oh yeah, Gorbachev, he's the Antichrist. I mean, some legitimate Christians who legitimately from trying to interpret apocalyptic language, well, you know, the beast with the mark on the head, you know, he's got that little birthmark there, that's the mark of the beast. And he's the Antichrist, and in the end's going to be any day now. Well, here we are, 25-plus years later, and as far as I know, it didn't quite turn out. I mean, I guess he's still alive. Isn't he still alive? But I don't think it's him, you know? And it's tricky and kind of dangerous when people kind of plug in a formula. Well, this equals this equals this equals this, especially when they do it with current events today. Real careful with that. So you know, you get into Revelation, and then the locusts are the helicopters that are Russians invading us, and, you know, you just kind of want to go, well. Now, at the same time, that doesn't mean that we can't have some good understanding of what the symbolism may be. And I'm going to directly tell you this morning what I think some of these symbols are in this chapter. Okay? But I will tell you that we have to be real careful with this kind of thing. And so let's talk more about apocalyptic language here and what's going on with it. Now, it doesn't mean then that these symbols mean, or that what the symbols mean or who that they refer to doesn't mean that we should be drawing up all kinds of details and kind of drawing up a map or a chart of how things are going to play out so that we can know, okay, then this and then this and then this and then Jesus is going to come back and it's going to be him. But that's what's dangerous, and that's what I'm warning of here. However, scholar Daniel Block correctly writes in reference to apocalyptic literature, and this isn't a however, this is saying the same thing of what I just said. He says, and I quote, "The intention of apocalyptic is not to chart out God's plan for the future so future generations can draw up calendars, but to assure the present generation that perhaps contrary to appearance, God is still on the throne and that the future is firmly in his hands." So here's what I'm getting at. Too often people with really good intentions focus on each and every symbol of apocalyptic literature and try to plug it in to pinpoint connections, okay? In regards to this symbol means this and that symbol means that. And then in the midst of doing that, here's what's dangerous. They miss the main message of the whole passage or the whole chapter or the whole point of all the symbolism. Because the symbolism is designed, almost like a parable that Jesus uses designed, to point to a specific message or point, usually. Okay? And that's what's going on with symbolic language. So symbolic language then is there to serve the main message, not to create its own message, and not to kind of focus in on every little detail what it means and kind of calculate all that's going to happen in the future. So with that said, as we're going to go through rest of Daniel from 7 through 12 in the next several weeks, and we're about the halfway point of Daniel, and this is going to take us up till right before Christmas till we finish. We're going to talk about some of this symbolic language, and I'm going to tell you some things that scholars and interpreters think that these symbols mean, and I'm going to be pretty specific on some of these things. However, we're not going to lose sight of the main message of it all, okay? And even if we take slightly different views on what some of the symbols may mean, we're going to focus on what the main message is, okay, of the whole context. So here's some tips. Here's some things that scholar Daniel Block writes to help us understand and interpret apocalyptic language. And I think this is helpful for us to know and understand that apocalyptic language, literature, tends to be characterized by these things, okay? First of all, there tends to have a distinction between the present age and the age to come in apocalyptic writing. So there's often distinctions. So it'll be like the world today versus what is to come, okay? Another one is there tends to be a perspective that the age to come is better. It's greater. It's going to be way better. When the age to come, when God is on his, you know, full and final consummation of his triumph and the kingdom of God fully and finally reigns and all evil, death, and pain is gone, it's going to be way better. You're not going to struggle or suffer anymore. Apocalyptic language describes that. Apocalyptic language tends to have a periodization of history. It tends to emphasize the imminent, meaning the soon arrival, the near arrival of God's reign and the demise of earthly powers. And we've seen some of that already, descriptions of that in Daniel. We're going to see it today. It often tends to have a cosmic perspective. It often tends to have the vindication of the righteous, meaning that the righteous are shown to be right. It tends to have involvement of supernatural beings and a messianic figure who carries out God's rule and reign. So these are all descriptors of apocalyptic language, and you'll see more and more of that today. These kinds of things you'll see today and as we continue through Daniel 7 through 12. So with that background, let's go ahead and go through the details of the first half of Daniel 7 here this morning. Chapter 7, notice it begins telling us that Daniel is writing or giving a report here about a vision that he had during the first year of the reign of Belshazzar. who was Belshazzar. Remember Daniel 5. Belshazzar is pretty much only mentioned. He is only mentioned in Daniel 5. He is not the guy of the first four chapters. That was Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Belshazzar is the guy who had the feast, right, and worshipped his false gods at this feast when they brought the vessels from the temple of Jerusalem in for their drinking party. And then the writing was on the wall, and that very night, Babylon fell. He was killed and conquered. And we talked about how ironic that was, that we were having our service at the exact date, October 11th, of which these events happened, of the feast. And then the fall of Babylon Empire, we know from extra-biblical sources in history, was October 12th, 539 BC. So this is the guy in power. It's Belshazzar. And the vision occurred then before the events of Daniel 5 and Daniel 6, in which God delivered Daniel from the lion's den under King Darius that we saw last week. So the time of this vision is approximately 522 BC, when Babylon is still the most powerful empire in the world. Their empire was vast. It's still the most powerful empire in the world, which is why Daniel and his friends are there in Babylon. Jerusalem's been conquered, and they were brought into exile there. So the report of the vision begins in verse 2. Daniel shares that he has this vision in the night, and he sees four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea. Four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea. Now, the four winds, you imagine a compass, right? North, south, east, west, right? If you look on a map, or I guess it would be this way if you're facing. North, south, east, west, if you're looking at a map, right? Or maybe it was the other way. Maybe I had it right. Okay, I had it right the first time. All right, yeah. So the idea of a compass, right, and four winds is kind of describing in every direction. So there's a comprehensive aspect to the four winds here to display that this is covering the earth from every direction. Now, the sea in the ancient world is, in both biblical literature and extra-biblical literature, was viewed by people as something that they were very afraid of. It was viewed as something that symbolized chaos and even evil powers in rebellion to God. But God had tamed and had power and authority over even the sea and even then evil powers. So the sea is often used as a symbol of chaos and evil powers in rebellion to God, of which God himself even has power over. So that's why, if you know the book of Jonah and the story of Jonah, everybody was freaking out in the midst of that storm. And then when Jonah is thrown into the water, the storm ceases because God had, you know, wanted that to happen, and God's power over even the power of the sea. Furthermore, the sea was considered the home of mighty and evil monsters that people, again, were afraid of. And I don't think they were just talking about big whales. There's a creature in the book of Job named Leviathan, who was considered this great and evil monster, almost like a, you know, who knows, it was like a dinosaur or something of the ocean. But it was a very feared monster that, again, is even considered in the book of Job as being under the power and authority of God, that God's even greater than that. So the sea is a symbol of chaos and evil powers and evil creatures in rebellion to God. And so as Daniel's reporting this vision and saying that the four winds are stirring up the sea from every direction, then he says there's four beasts that come out of the sea. And each of these beasts are different. And strangely, each of these beasts are not like typical beasts. They are kind of like hybrid creatures. They're mixes of a few beasts together, if you will, a few different animals together, different animals. So, for example, this first beast, notice it says here, it's like a lion, but what's different about it, it has eagle's wings. Scholar Sidney Gradanus states that hybrid beasts coming out of the sea, being different from the animals in the rest of creation, would depict, and I quote, disorder and hostility to God. Gradanus points out that God had created the animals we know in Genesis, each according to their kind. So God had created these animals specifically according to their kind, and yet we have these like weird mutation like animals here, these beasts. You know, this lion with eagle's wings, like that's disorder. That's different. That's even symbolic of hostility towards God here, because it's different than anything else existing in God's creation. Furthermore, such hybrid beasts, Gradonis points out, were considered unclean by the Jews from the food laws given to God's people in Leviticus 11 and 14. So such creatures that were different like that would be considered unclean. Now, in Daniel's vision of the description of this first beast, this lion with eagle's wings, he then mentions, notice that the wings are plucked off, right? And then he says that the beast stands up on 2 feet like a man, and then it's the mind of a man is given to it. It seems kind of strange, doesn't it? Well, the context of this chapter with the book of Daniel points, as a whole, it points back to each of these beasts being representative of kings and kingdoms ruling and reigning throughout history. In fact, later in this chapter, look with me here at verse 17, God reveals to Daniel the interpretation of these four beasts, and he writes, and I quote, "These four great beasts are four kings who shall rise out of the earth." So I'm not making a huge jump in symbolic interpretation right here. I'm just going what the scripture says. I'm not saying this equals this. I mean, it's telling you right here, these are four kings. These symbols mean four kings. It's kind of like when Jesus explains the parable. The parable of the soils, well, the first seed that fell in the ground, it's this, and then the second seed that fell in the ground, he's telling us right here in this chapter what it means. Four kingdoms. Okay? These four beasts are four kings who shall rise out of the earth. Now, furthermore, we also need to understand that this chapter, Daniel 7, has parallels with Daniel 2. If you were with us back in Daniel 2, we called it the nightmare on B Street. Okay? Because Nebuchadnezzar has this dream that deeply disturbs him. And he doesn't tell anyone what it is, and he doesn't know what it means. And nobody can, and he threatens to kill everybody. All the dream experts, all the dream interpretationers, the Chaldeans and the folks that were apparently had those gifts, you know, he's going to put them all to death. But Daniel goes, wait a minute, you know, and he prays and he seeks God, and God gives him not just the dream, it's using both the dream, what it was, and the interpretation. He shares it with Nebuchadnezzar. If you remember the dream, the nightmare on B Street, as I called it, Babylon Street, he has this great image. He sees this great image, and there's like a gold head and silver arms, bronze feet, and then this stone comes and breaks us apart. And so there's different things that refer to different kingdoms in Daniel 2 as the interpretation of the dream is given. And see, this chapter in Daniel 7 is paralleling Daniel 2, okay? So this is some 50 years later, and in that passage and interpretation that Daniel gives to Nebuchadnezzar, the four kingdoms were being representative. This first beast here in Daniel 7 is like the head of gold in Daniel 2, and it's representative of Babylon, the Babylonian Empire, the kingdom that is ruling and reigning right there and then. And evidence that this first beast refers to Babylon and to King Nebuchadnezzar is that remember when Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4, he's humbled, he loses his mind, he looks and he acts and he lives like a beast. Do you remember that? So then his kingdom is restored in Daniel 4. He's given his right mind again. And Daniel had told him that that would happen too, interpreting another dream, and it did. Well, further evidence that this first beast is Babylon and King Nebuchadnezzar is that the Old Testament prophets actually pointed towards Nebuchadnezzar. They refer to Nebuchadnezzar actually as being a lion and an eagle. This is wild. Jeremiah 4, verse 7, Jeremiah 50, verse 17, and Jeremiah 50, verse 44, and then they refer to him as an eagle in Jeremiah 48:40 and Ezekiel 17:3. So when Nebuchadnezzar is referred to by these prophets, sometimes they refer to him as a lion and sometimes like an eagle. So what happens to Nebuchadnezzar? He is, you know, loses his mind. He's out living and looking like an animal. And then he's brought upright again and restored. His kingdom is restored and he's given his right mind again. What does the animal here do? The wings are plucked off. Then it stands up like a man and has a right mind again. And other prophets point towards Nebuchadnezzar being symbolically referred to as being domineering like a lion, the most powerful king, animal creature, and the most powerful in the bird of the birds was an eagle. And so he's, you know, they're symbolizing him with this because of his great power, because his kingdom was the greatest the world had seen up to that point. Furthermore, to add to this, one writer points out that in Babylon, in ancient Babylon, there was a major processional street. So think like Main Street. Think Las Vegas Strip here in our town, like the main street where people go down. And all along the main processional street, like Main Street of Babylon, or the Strip of Babylon, was all of these statues of what? Lions with eagle's wings. Is that cool or what? I mean, we found this stuff. We found these things in history. So it's pretty, there's a lot of basis that supports that this first creature, this first beast, is pointing directly to Babylon and the kingdom of Babylon, of which Nebuchadnezzar was primary. And the kingdom of Babylon reigned from 605 to 539 BC. Okay? Now let's talk about the second beast. Pick up with me in verse 5. Verse 5 mentions a second beast. This one's like a bear. But it's a different type of bear. This bear is raised up on one side. Think like weird hunchback. You know, it's like one side is way higher than the other. This bear has three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And it was told to arise and devour much flesh. And verse 6 mentions a third beast. This one is like a leopard, but this leopard, a very, very fast creature, has four wings of a bird on its back, which indicates that it could be even faster, right, if it flies. And this beast has four heads, and dominion was given to it. Who are these second and third beasts? Well, remember Daniel 2. The gold image is Babylon, and then the silver and bronze were the kingdoms that came after Babylon. So these four kings and four kingdoms, Daniel 7:17 said these beasts are four kings. And so from the parallel passage of Daniel 2 as well, we establish clearly that the first beast was Babylon, and when Daniel 2 told us the interpretation of the dream, and that the subsequent kingdoms that arose after it, and then that all of them would be eventually destroyed. So that's what Daniel 2 told us. This second beast is referring then to the kingdom that replaced Babylon, that came after. We know from Daniel 5 and from other historical sources where the fall of Babylon is mentioned that the next kingdom is the Medes and the Persians. And we talked about that in Daniel 5. When that very night, you know, the kingdom is, the Babylon falls and Belshazzar is put to death, and then the Medes and Persians rule and reign. So they came in and conquered Babylon. In the sense, what did they do? In the sense, they ate it up. They devoured it, and they assimilated that kingdom, including Daniel and the other Jews that were still in exile in Babylon. So the empire of the Medes and Persians was known to kind of come in and devour up nations and kingdoms and eat them up. And what was also known within the empire of the Medes and Persians is that the Persians were known for being the more powerful or dominant side of this collective union of the Medes and Persians. So, this second beast that parallels the chest of the and arms of silver in the dream of Daniel 2 is the kingdom of the Medes and Persians. And the reason the bear is raised up on one side and has ribs in its mouth is to symbolize that the Persian part were more powerful, and the things that the bear is eating are the other kingdoms that it has conquered, symbolic of the other kingdoms that it's conquered. The second beast of the kingdom of the Medes and Persians was in power from 539 to 331 BC. The third beast points to the next subsequent king and kingdom, which is Greece. This third kingdom, this leopard, is one of the fastest animals in the kingdom. And if the leopard were to have wings to fly, it would be even faster. What you may or may not know is that the Greek Empire conquered very, very quickly. Alexander the Great was known to have pretty much conquered the world in a matter of 10 years of being in power. I mean, there was a swiftness to which they dominated the world in the previous kingdoms. In a matter of years, it swiftly conquered large and vast territory, even larger than the previous kingdoms of the Babylon Empire and the Medo-Persian Empire. And notice it states right here that this beast was given dominion. what's also interesting is that after Alexander died, the kingdom, the Greek Empire, was basically split into four heads. Four of Alexander's generals, Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Cassander, I think I'm saying those all correctly. I was taught when you can't pronounce something, just say it really fast, and nobody would know. So I tried to say Lysimachus really fast, but these four generals really did, were four heads, and the Greek Empire was basically then, you know, it's still one empire, but it's led by four heads. What does this leopard have? Four heads. It's really interesting. This beast parallels then the belly and thighs of bronze in the image of Daniel 2. And there it's stated in Daniel 2:39. Notice it's said in Daniel 2:39 that this third kingdom of bronze would rule over all the earth. And again, the Greek Empire was even greater than the previous Babylonian and Medo-Persian Empire. Even further confirmation that this third beast is Greek, the Greek Empire, is found at what we'll see soon when we get to Daniel 8. In Daniel 8, the angel Gabriel is telling Daniel what the symbolism being referred to in Daniel 8 means, and there's a reference made to the kingdom, the king of Greece. So the third beast here is the Greek Empire, the Greek king Alexander, and those four heads that followed, which reigned from 331 to 63 BC. Next, a fourth beast is seen in Daniel's vision. Verse 7, this beast is more terrifying and strong. Note that it says that. It has great iron teeth. It devoured and it breaks in pieces and stamps with its feet whatever remains. This beast, it says, is different from all of the previous beasts. And it also has 10 horns. This beast parallels the kingdom of iron mentioned in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel 2. In Daniel 2:4, it stated this, there shall be a fourth kingdom strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron crushes, it shall break and crush all these. This means that this kingdom will defeat and conquer all previous kingdoms. And again, now this kingdom is greater than the ones preceding it. What has history shown us was the next kingdom and empire in power after the Greek Empire? What was the kingdom that was said was that we said was represented in Daniel 2 in the description of the kingdom of iron? It's Rome. Yeah, it's the Roman Empire. And history has shown us that the Roman Empire was characterized by its legions and how these legions would go powerfully conquer and crush their opponents. They had a little trouble up in Gaul from time to time. But in general, they conquered a territory greater than the world had ever seen. The most powerful and universal empire of all previous empires. And as previously, just as there were four heads with the leopard, they referred to how the Greek Empire broke up into four heads that then continued until the Greek Empire was conquered. The 10 horns of this beast seems to refer to how the Roman Empire would eventually, in a sense, be split into other kingdoms. Now, let me try to explain this because this is a little tricky to understand. How have 10 kingdoms been subsequent to the Roman Empire? Have there been 10 kingdoms subsequent to the Roman Empire? Yes, and one could argue there have been more than 10. Let me explain. The number 10 seems to be too limited. There's been more than 10 kingdoms that have kind of come out of the Roman Empire, that have come out of the influence and defeat of the Roman Empire. The number 10 is probably not meant to be a literal number here. Again, we're in apocalyptic language that is known for its symbolism. What you may or may not know is that the number 10 was typically used to symbolize completeness. It was symbolic of something that